Welcome back to the Compass live stream, the best and coincidentally the only live stream dedicated to proof of work mining. We have three awesome guests on the show today. And as always, my fantastic co-host, Will. Will, thanks for coming on the show again. This conversation should be super fun. It's a little bit different than most of the other conversations we've had. I'm expecting it to, you know, be pretty heated at times. The more heated, the better. But thanks for hosting with me.
For sure. I think it's great timing too. Bitmain just had a conference the other week, and there's a lot of people who went on stage to shill some of their group. And I'm excited to get some like first person reactions to that topic specifically. But of course, green mining has kind of been the topic du jour for the whole year. So excited to dive into it.
Yeah, it's popularity and notoriety has ramped up significantly over the past 12 months and a little bit more, I guess. And we want to unpack some of that, find some balance, pick out which parts of that often troublesome narrative are true, which aren't. And honestly, I don't think there's anyone better to do it with us than Marty, Steve, and Ryan, all good friends of us, of Compass, and miners that we have a lot of respect for. It's all three of you guys. Thanks for coming on the stream. It's awesome having all of you here with us this afternoon. I want to start off by giving you guys a chance to introduce yourselves. You all work at, I'm sure most of our audience is familiar with the companies that you all work with, but I want to know a little bit more about the particulars of what you're building right now, what you're working on in mining. Marty, if you want to start, I know you've had some recent news also in terms of what you're involved in, where you're working with, and then Steve and Ryan, I want to hear from you guys too, if you don't mind giving quick intros.
Yeah, so I'm Marty Bent, the Director of Business Development at Great American Mining. And the news that Zach was just alluding to was that I recently joined the board of directors at Fortress Blockchain up in Canada. And so long story short, probably more to talk about Great American Mining specifically, but what we do is we mine Bitcoin, and we do that in upstream of oil and gas operations, particularly on the well pad where they would otherwise flare gas. We go, we show up, we convince them to allow us to pipe that gas to generators, which powers mobile containers that we design and construct in-house filled with Bitcoin miners. I guess that's the skinny of it.
That's awesome. That's a good rundown. Steve, I know our audience has heard from you before, but can you give us a quick intro?
Yep. I'm the owner of Upstream Data. We are based in Canada. Same lines as Marty and Ryan here. We're focused on upstream oil and gas, Bitcoin mining. I started the company focusing primarily on like vent gas, because that's a huge issue up here. But the whole vent flare stranded gas thing is what we go after. And we sort of like, I position my company as like a service provider. So we more or less are like an OEM, like we build equipment and ship it to people and more than us mining ourselves. Although we do a little bit of self mining. It's just not even close to what, in terms of like, say, revenue is what we do for just building and shipping. So building, designing is what I focus on.
Awesome. Yeah. Ryan, can you give us the quick rundown on what you're building also?
Yeah, you bet. So Ryan Leachman, we're at J Energy. We're based out of Wyoming. We've got a mining site here in Wyoming, but you know, kind of similar to Steve, we've got oil and gas backgrounds here, which led us into Bitcoin mining. And we build all of our containers and mining equipment, everything here in Casper, Wyoming. And yeah, our site uses natural gas here in Wyoming as well. And so we can offer our solutions to other people as well.
Awesome. Yeah. So I didn't want to spoil it ahead of time, but I kind of intentionally wanted all three of you on the stream just because y'all are working in probably one of the most interesting parts of mining in my mind. And I think it intertwines like pretty importantly with the conversation we're going to have today about the environmental impact of mining and what is basically true and false about that, that pretty powerful narrative surrounding mining. I guess like the big three-letter acronym that everyone talks about is ESG, and might as well be a good enough starting point for this conversation. Like, super open-ended question, but like why, like, what is ESG? Like, why are we talking about it now, I guess, is the foundation and also like the springboard for this conversation. Because you've had, you know, critiques of Bitcoin and mining and everything over Bitcoin's entire existence of, is it good for anything? Does anyone use it? Like, is it all a scam and pointless? But the focus on environmental effects of mining have really ramped up in the past 12 to 18 months, focused around ESG narratives that are, you know, touching a lot of other industries besides Bitcoin. So like, what is this exactly? Kind of want to know takes from all three of you on what this is. Ryan, I guess just hand it back to you and then we can go around again.
Yeah, I mean, I actually went through my email history to try to find the first time I ever saw ESG thrown at me in an email. And it was in early 2019, actually. And my reply to the email, well, so what the question actually was, hey, can you give us a quick slide on our ESG impacts? It was for an investor relations slide. And my reply back is, what the hell is an ESG? You know, I was thinking operations. And so, you know, thinking like in oil and gas operations, we've got so many different acronyms for everything. And I'm like, how is there an acronym that I don't know right now?
Yeah.
And the reply back was basically like, seriously? And so I'm like Googling it and I'm like, okay, so environmental, social, governance. And I was like, okay, I got this. I'm like, why are we calling it ESG? Like pretty much every investor relations slide we've done for the last basically forever hits on all three of these things. But I was, you know, at that point in time, you're not really seeing kind of where this is going. And so, you know, on the oil and gas side, we're like, well, the environmental, let's talk about some of the wins that we've had. And then on the social side, you say, okay, let's talk about, you know, how are we involved in our communities? What are we doing to be engaged in it? And, you know, what's our social license to operate? And then on the governance side, you say, you know, what is it that as a company, you know, we're doing to create long-term value for all of our stakeholders involved? And so you kind of look at it at a 30,000 foot view and you're like, yeah, I mean, ESG is basically a, you know, a pathway to long-term value that you create for your company. I mean, if you don't have a positive ESG story, you probably don't have the right initiatives in mind. But I, somewhere along that way, that narrative got hijacked and, you know, it's changed to be within those three terms, there's only specific standards that are acceptable to give you a positive ESG score. Whereas, you know, looking back as to where it came from, it's very hard to argue that the idea or premise behind ESG is a bad thing because it's not. It's how it's been hijacked and coined to say like, now these are the only acceptable things that we'll consider positive ESG. Whereas really all companies should have a long-term value creation plan for their companies anyways, but that's just not the case with ESG anymore.
Yeah, it's I see it as like same way you said, like it's sort of like a well-intended, it's the whole thing about ESG, it's all for the good, but it's, you know, the way they're administering it, it's becoming this secondary system of account. So for the first time in history, like a company now has to, instead of, you know, basing your business around, you know, generating profits and look, all companies are already motivated to do good work in the community. It's not something that you need some third party administrator to enforce. It's already part of like social fabric to hire local people, create jobs, do good things. I mean, there's not a company out there trying to do bad for the environment. Now, when companies do bad things to the environment, like dump crap into the rivers and stuff, that's why we have regulatory agencies in place to try to curtail that kind of thing. But at this point, like especially when it comes to like oil and gas, ESG, the E side of the ESG is the biggest thing. It's the environmental footprint. And it's the, in particular, the carbon accounting aspect of it. How much carbon emissions do you have? Oh, you have too much? Well, you have to pay us money now because we're the carbon accountants. And this is our divine right to strip you of that money. And we'll spend it instead of you because we're better than you. And that's sort of what it's this secondary accounting system now. It's no longer about like a business. It's no longer about building a good business, creating a great product, making a margin and growing your business and offering something the world wants and needs. Now you have this second layer of accounting on top of it, the carbon accounting and the ESG accounting, that not only do you have to be a good business with a good product, but you actually have to have this entire other accounting system that is completely subjective. Like who is administering this? Why is this project qualify and this one doesn't? And there's so much pathway for corruption and bureaucracy in there. And it's pretty clear that it's happening. I can tell you, it's so easy to discriminate against a company if you don't understand what they're doing, or maybe not even discriminate, but just not properly, allocate the benefits that they're, the ESG benefits that they're offering. Like early on when I started my business, I was like, oh, well, we're going to be doing a lot of emissions reduction stuff. This is great. I went and applied for all this, this is really early on. I went and was like, oh, we're going to do emission stuff. Let's apply for these emissions programs. And we easily had the best value proposition around, especially for this upstream oil field stuff. And we weren't successful on anything that we did, because at the end of the day, there's someone sitting in a chair in their cubicle looking at someone's application. They don't get it. They don't understand it. And they say, no, you don't fit the bill, and throw it out. Like it's not a natural business mechanism. It's a bureaucrat, like top down administrative mechanism. And honestly, it's pure evil and should be resisted at all costs. Marty would agree, don't you, Marty?
I know Marty agrees. Marty, jump in there.
I do agree. And what Ryan and Steve have described up to this point has been incredible. I wholeheartedly agree with everything they've said. And I think just to add something to this conversation, somebody I've been reading their blog on this subject recently is Eswath Damodaran. He's a professor at NYU Stern School of Business. And I think he has a very interesting explanation for why ESG has gotten to where it is today, to the point where it's like this weird totalitarian allocation of capital strategy. And he describes basically it's an abdication of individuals at the end of the day. They don't want to actually do good in their own lives. They want to push that responsibility onto the companies and the investment advisors they're doing business with. They're sort of giving this decision on how to be a good consumer to the investment class, and then they're pushing that up to the corporate class, and it's sort of dictating what is being done and the standards that are being architected that now people have to fall into, or they don't get capital. And so it's this weird roundabout thing where individuals don't want to take responsibility and actually act in a way in which they're helping the environment and being cognizant of how much they're consuming and what they're consuming and the impact of that on the environment. They're pushing that decision elsewhere, and it's creating this weird Frankenstein system of allocating capital. And then he dropped a blog post yesterday. I think he does an incredible job of highlighting the subjective nature of ESG that Steve alluded to earlier, where it's just, you're never going to have, these standards are never going to work because everything's subjective. People have different value systems and they value things in the economy differently and have different sort of pro cons with each economic decision. Like there's no form fit ESG metrics that everybody's going to fall into. You're essentially reducing everybody to an input in a very mathematic function. And that's just not the way humans work. We're social animals. We have free will. We have differences of opinion. And you can't basically force a metric system of the subjective concept of good onto the whole market.
Marty, Steve, one tweet I've seen from both of you, or one tweet idea I've seen from both of you, is that E in the ESG is emphasized so much more than the S and the G. And if you like are taking it from a morality standpoint, the S and the G, especially the S, matters so much more than the E. But that's not how we've kind of seen it play out. Why do you think that's happened? Like, why has the E kind of taken over the whole conversation? Marty, I want to throw it back to you for your thoughts on that.
I think it's just the lowest hanging fruit. Obviously, we talk about like the war on terror, the war on like climate change, like it's in these big sort of Malthusian fears that people have that like, these are existential crises that we need to deal with. So I think the E is just the lowest hanging fruit, where it's like everybody cares about the environment. Right? Here's how we do.
Well, It's the carbon, right? Like the carbon is in the E, like the carbon accounting. Mm-hmm. And the carbon is how they're scamming everyone, right? Like they're saying that, okay, you, based on your business and your industry niche, we've categorized, like you could say anything, like you're a mechanic shop, you run, you're a mechanic. You generally, you know, is shop your size generally runs this much power. This is your industry and you get this score. And that's where it's going. They're going to have everyone categorized and based on like, this part of the industry has this kind of emissions and this kind of industry has this. And that's how the taxes, like the carbon taxes are going to be administered. I mean, the whole thing is like, when you really break it down, when I say it's a scam, it's because I look at it as it's a complete and utter scam. There's not a single thing that the carbon accounting system is doing that's good for the environment. There's not a single thing. I mean, people are attacking. And I mean, before even I was into Bitcoin, like me and Ryan come from oil. We've been dealing with this environmental scamming, like garbage it's been being dealt with now for decades, but it's been like ramping up. It's becoming quite difficult. Like, for example, if you're trying to start an oil company today, I mean, first of all, nobody has any money. Everyone's poor and debt enslaved. So you need to go out and with your good idea, pitch it and get funding. You're not going to get funded right today unless you have an ESG story. It has nothing to do with producing oil efficiently and being good stewards of the environment. You just have to have the story and you got to pay people. You have to have someone on staff constantly updating your story and like just constantly bullshitting to get you to get you accepted and to get the funding. And to get whether it's like if you are going after some kind of like grants or anything like that, you know, at the end of the day, the carbon tax, all it is a reallocation of wealth. So when we're talking the E, it's the lowest hanging fruit, as Marty said, but it's already being administered here pretty heavily up in Canada. Like there's already a carbon tax. And basically what the government's doing is they're taking money from us, like all of us in Canada, but producers as well, they're taking that, saying that, oh, you're bad for the environment, so give us some more money. We give it to the government, who then spends the money instead of us. So they go out and consume instead of us, but they do it so much more less efficient. Like it's full of, like, just look at what happens with governments. It's just full of corruption. Half that money they take in is just being sucked up by the bureaucrats and the administration of that money. And then what does get reallocated is going into the dumbest projects like imaginable. Like I'm in Alberta. I'm sitting in Alberta right now. A lot of this carbon tax money, especially in our prior government when it was the NDP, so like more of a left-wing government, was being pushed into solar projects. We have immense wasted and stranded natural gas in this province to power the grids off solar in Alberta. When you have wasted natural gas everywhere, is ridiculous. It just makes no sense whatsoever. And if you actually, like, as hard as it is to actually quantify what the carbon emissions are, because they make some ridiculously bad assumptions to try to quantify it, if you actually look down to it, these projects are emitting more environmental harm and resource consumption and resource waste than we would have otherwise had we not administered this bullshit. And that to me is, you know, it's really just more top down fiat maximalist scamming, trying to suck capital out of the public and basically benefit from it themselves, because the environment's not benefiting and people aren't benefiting. So at the end of the day, it's just the bureaucrats, their administrators, and they're just lining their pockets with this stuff.
Ryan, yeah, if I was going to jump in there quick on that, I think it's echoing a lot what Marty and Steve have both said, but you know, my biggest thing is if you follow the incentives of who's to gain, you know, it comes back down kind of the money thing. And so if you look at ESG, where is the biggest place that you can profit? And it's starting new companies to, you know, new solar companies, new wind companies, you know, these projects, as you know, Steve was just mentioning, is that, you know, E is where the most money potential is to be made for these initiatives to be put into place. So that's where the incentive is. So that's really kind of just how I look at it, is, you know, that's the reason the E is the biggest thing in the ESG story.
And it's hypocrisy across the board. You got like, all right, you're basically like, when I mentioned the solar stuff. So we're subsidizing this solar, these terrible solar projects in Alberta. These solar panels are come from China, built by, you know, not to go down this rabbit hole, but built by ethnic slaves. So built like by costs, the, and they're made by coal too, which is a joke, but it's built by ethnic slaves, like the Uyghur population that's being enslaved in China. They're building panels, and it's not just solar panels. They're building all kinds of stuff in China with this stuff, with this slavery. But I mean, we're instead of enriching and helping like local manufacturers, whether they're making engines and pipelines and whatever else they're building, we're stripping them of that wealth, giving it to China, who are enforcing slave labor, who are sending us coal panels, which are really cheap. Solar panels, I call them coal panels, but solar panels, which are cheap because of the slave labor. Where's the S in that situation? Where's the social, you know, the social, the value in, on social, like Brian described it earlier, like just the idea of having a, being good to your fellow man, that's not happening. No. with renewables. Like it's the complete opposite, but no one's quantifying that. That's no problem. The Fiat Maxis keep funding it because it's no problem, because it's not on anyone's radar.
Yeah. So again, it's like it's a byproduct of this abdication of responsibility of the individual. They don't care. They don't see it. And they're just, hey, it's ESG certified. I'm good. I'm a good citizen. I'm doing my part to reduce the carbon. And again, like you're focusing on the S here, Steve, with this particular situation with this polysilicon coming out of China, you can lean into the E as well. Like you mentioned, it takes a lot of coal to produce that. And then on the back end, recycling it, it takes a shit ton more coal as well, correct?
Absolutely. Like here we are shutting down all across North America, our beautiful coal plants. They're reliable, cheap coal that is making insane amount of jobs, lowering our cost basis for everything. And instead of us doing it over here, the Chinese and the other countries that aren't clamping down on it are ramping up their coal production. So it's just all it is we're redistributing jobs and fossil fuel consumption from, say, Canada and the U.S. and giving it, letting China emit it instead of us, probably more inefficiently as well, because they don't have as high standards on emissions compliance. They don't have as high standards on their coal plants, you know, scavenging the crap that comes out of like flue gas in the coal plants. And so like Marty said, we're just like kicking the bucket over there and like, oh yeah, we're emissions compliant here in Canada. We're hitting our 2030 like Nazi goals. But over there in China, they're doing like the net on the globe is much worse than what it would have been if these people stayed the hell away, right?
Well, we already see, I was just going to follow up with that. We already see the effects of this, right? Like England and some other country, there were headlines the past week that they're having to turn on coal plants again because the green energy that they're producing like just isn't sufficient to meet current demand. And like the hypocrisy angle is really interesting. I haven't thought about that. I mean, it's there, and it sort of feeds from maybe an underlying issue that Steve, you mentioned a couple different times, that it like the whole ESG thing is just introducing a secondary and more obscure system of measurement, and bureaucracy thrives in obscurity and sort of in shadows and in all of these ambiguous situations, as does hypocrisy, which, you know, all too often goes hand in hand with bureaucracy. I mean, maybe we shouldn't assume 100% evil intent, but like there's not really much doubt to give benefit to in this situation. They've created like an ideal environment of obscurity and sort of fly by the seat of your pants rulemaking, where they pick winners and losers based on hunches and biases instead of, you know, objective accounting measures. So Will, sorry, go ahead, jump in there. I just wanted to follow up on that.
No, sorry, I didn't want to stomp on you there. And so Marty has a thought too. And I don't know how well this historical comparison is going to land, but this the way I've been thinking a lot about this is William Wilberforce in the 1800s and his movement to abolish slave trade in England. And he had the hardest time getting that implemented because slave labor was used to produce sugar crops that was brought over to the UK and then brought over to the rest of the British Empire. In the same way with this ESG thing going on right now, it's so easy to get the E done, but it's so hard to get the S and the G done. Why? Because kids aren't going to go without their Nikes. They want that cotton from China that's produced by slave labor, and they want those cheap solar panels, and that's not going to go away. So you really have to have some sort of ethical motivations behind your conversation here and try to get like a populist movement going. Otherwise, people are just going to follow the incentives. Like, it's cheaper to produce Nikes and make Nikes that everyone wants to wear using slave labor, and no one's willing to talk about it. It's not going to change anyone's opinion. People are very okay wearing shoes that are made very much so with like blood from slave labor. It's not going to change anyone's opinion.
Yeah. I think,
you're right. Ryan.
No, I was just thinking, you know, Marty touched on the point where he was kind of alluding to like trying to take like the entire supply chain of everything into effect. So, you know, look at how things are created, look how things are shipped, look how things are built, look how things operate, and then look at how those things are then reclaimed. Because everybody should have an obligation to any project that they're doing, have a plan in place as to how that's going to be reclaimed at the end. And, you know, the biggest narrative out there is that, you know, this form of energy is good and other forms of energy are bad. And why? It's because, you know, it's green, clean, or it's renewable. It doesn't emit any carbon. That's true to say to some extent about some forms of energy if you look at one particular process. But when you go back and you start looking into the entire supply chain, as, you know, Marty alluded to, that's where that narrative falls apart. You know, but it's so easy to have blinders on for the general population that doesn't completely understand, you know, the entire supply chain of certain forms of energy. And so when you're saying that this form of energy is good, I mean, you can technically shoot a hole in any form of energy as to where it does have some negative environmental impact. I mean, there isn't one that doesn't exist. I mean, if the narrative was true that everybody really did want everything to be as clean as possible, you'd probably see a lot more nuclear plants being built, which you don't see. But I mean, you can, you know, we've already talked about, you know, solar, where, you know, the process is involved to build it. It's, you know, mining intensive, which uses fossil fuels, which the environmental standards in those countries aren't anywhere near what we would consider to be like where we need to be in this country, but they build it over there, so we're fine with it. And then at the end of the life, like, take a look at how a lot of these wind or solar, you know, applications are disposed of, especially solar, which say, you know, give it 10, 15, 20, 25 years before it needs to be disposed of. If you just leave that out in the environment and rain hits it and it starts leaching into the ground, like, you've got a bunch of different materials that are, you know, obviously corrosive, but a lot of that material we send back to developing countries that will take it for a lot cheaper than what we could dispose of it here. And so, you know, there's a lot of fingers that you could point. And, you know, so then people go, well, let's only do hydro. And then it's like, okay, well, a lot of hydro dams, if you've driven past them, they're, you know, say 500 or 700 or 1,000 feet of water that they flooded a mountain valley and displaced animals and, you know, covered trees and grass and everything in water. And what happens when organic material like trees and grass and water are covered in, or trees and grass are buried in water, you know, they decompose and they emit methane. Like, you can literally shoot a hole if you want to go after any form of energy. So really the conversation should be not one form of energy is good, but for your specific application in your specific region, what is the most net benefit positive form of energy that is the most efficient, the most reliable, and really provides the most value? And depending on your location, where you are, that's going to be different. But the problem is that it's, you know, fossil fuels especially have just been attacked so hard, and that really you could easily make the argument that they provide, without a doubt, the most net positive benefit to society as a whole.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Marty.
I was going to say, I think a point that I would add on to Ryan's is, again, going back to the fact that individuals and just want to give the responsibility to someone else. They don't want to have extreme ownership over their understanding of this topic. But I think that's important. Like, we need to get better education out there about how energy is extracted and delivered to market in different forms. And like Ryan said, there's going to be a different energy mix depending on your locality. Like, we're seeing in El Salvador, they have huge geothermal potential, and that's great. And like, you can't just use geothermal in the middle of Texas because there aren't any volcanoes. Like that simple. The understanding of a simple concept like that, like, these are the variables you have to take into consideration when you're considering energy use, energy delivery, production, the wide swath brush of saying, all right, everybody needs to transition to wind and solar all over the place right now. Like in Alberta, you were mentioning it earlier, Steve, like, does it even make sense to have solar up there? Are there long winters with a lot of clouds?
Well, it's not a great, geographically, I don't think it's a great place to have solar in general. It's the meme, right? It's like, oh, solar is green, therefore we need to spend taxpayer dollars and tax these other industries to subsidize it. But no, and I mean, solar, of course, has its reliability issues. But yeah, Alberta is a terrible place to do it. It just makes no sense. And I mean, if it was different, if we didn't have like all these abundant resources up here that are being wasted, then okay, like maybe it has a place up here. But like when you're when you literally have all hell for a basement, right? Like that's like that song. I don't know if you heard that song, but like literally Alberta sits on oil. It's just all oil under this whole goddamn province. Why? And you have all this, all these wells, like why? And they're being wasted. Like it makes no sense to do any of that. The only comment I wanted to make on just that, this last little bit, is that like the trap that I think all of the world has fell into, like that the fiat maxis have set, is that the, this idea that there's some, that there is an existence of green technology or clean technology. It doesn't exist. Like it's an arbitrary, meaningless word. And they quantified, they came up with the carbon system to quantify it. But that's not, at the end of the day, it's not the emissions that we need to worry about. You know, if you're using diesel to haul a trailer across the country, like it's not that what we should be worrying about. It's if you hauled a trailer across the country and realized like you forgot the load in the trailer, well, that's a waste of diesel. That's a problem. But if you actually got there and you didn't waste the energy, well, you're good. Resource waste is the problem. So like if you go out and set up, like there's plenty of examples just on the topic of like solar and stuff where they set up these massive solar farms and they ended up going bankrupt and they're rotting away in the desert. Those were a massive waste of resources. And that's the problem. Like human resource waste is the problem, not emissions. Like emissions, you cannot get away from emissions. Nuclear has emissions. You can't run a nuclear facility without diesel. You need diesel to mine the uranium, and you need to do all the other processes to refine it, the whole supply chain thing. So it might have a net lower emissions over like the life cycle, but at the end of the day, emissions are never going away on any technology unless you want to go back to tribes. And I don't think anyone does. So we shouldn't be like, as soon as like, what I hate seeing is when I see, say, like, you know, when I see oil companies trying to justify their business based on their emissions, it's like, as soon as you start legitimate, like, as soon as you admit that carbon, the carbon accounting system and green and clean is a legitimate system of discourse, then you've already lost. Like, there's no coming back from that. It's not the problem. The problem is how we're, whenever humanity is wasting stuff, that's the stuff we can actually measurably control. Like we can stop that. We can stop wasting stuff if we actually put our minds to that. But unfortunately, that's not what, you know, what people are trained to think about right now. Everyone's been trained and brainwashed to think that carbon emissions matter. They don't matter at all.
I mean, I agree with all of that. I think waste is probably even more of a devious term than green or clean, because across the board, like waste in terms of like what you decide to allocate resources to is almost entirely subjective. And what you think might be wasteful to the other person is absolutely not. It's a productive use, deployment of some sort of resources.
One way, what I've argued on how to quantify it is just economics. Like if you start a business, if you have a project, could be any size project, but if there's no payout, like you did the project, it failed, that was a waste. Like that's objectively a waste. Now you might have gained knowledge and stuff, I know, but generally speaking, like businesses that start and fail, turn like from an objective view, were wastes of capital. That's always going to be happen. That's part of the inventive process. You try things, you fail. But that is effectively how waste is measured. It's measured from an economic standpoint, return on capital. If there's no return on the capital, like if you run a solar panel on your roof and you have no return, you've wasted a lot of money and time and resources doing that. Like you're bad for the environment.
Sure. Yeah. I want to steer this a little bit back to, or not steer it back towards mining, but just like distill it a little bit towards mining, with like, Steve and Ryan, you both have mentioned you've been in oil and gas for your careers before Bitcoin. And I like the follow up to all of this discussion, a question that I've tried to sort of figure out is like, why mining now? Like you've mentioned how ESG has been an issue, annoyance or whatever else in oil and gas and other industries for decades. Like what Rubicon did Bitcoin cross or what social catalyst was there or something? Was it even something as simple as like a price level that Bitcoin reached that through Bitcoin mining or proof of work mining, maybe more generally into this ESG ring and put us under the gun with these other industries that have been under the ESG gun, you know, for decades? Or was it just like random and inevitable, I guess, and it just sort of happened? Ryan, I guess first to you and then pass it around. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, my story into Bitcoin is due to oil and gas as opposed to the other way around. So I was a partner in an oil company, a private backed oil company. We're based out of Wyoming. We drilled an exploration well. The well was drilled in 2018. We brought it online in 2019. And, you know, the thing about exploration wells is that you're trying to prove a particular, you know, place that nobody else is, or, you know, fringes of a basin that obviously nobody else is drilling yet. You don't have a full development plan there yet. And, what that means is that there's a lack of infrastructure in place in that area. And so we drilled this well, we brought it online and, you know, Wyoming has a certain amount of days that you're allowed to flare wells for when you first bring them online. In order for us to prove the economics of this well, in order to justify drilling more or putting infrastructure in place, we required that well to be online and producing our oil. Well, in order to do so, we need to flare our gas. But you can only flare for a certain amount of days based on the regulations. So you still know that you're running up against that clock and you need your well online. You need to test it. You need to prove it. You need to make your economics back on your, you know, get a return on your investment. And so, you know, we looked at putting a pipeline in at the time, and it was just, you know, the cost at the time would kill the economics. And so we were looking at all different options that we could. So in 2019, we put our first Bitcoin mine on that well to get rid of the flare, to make sure that we could get under what the regulations and the requirements were. I'll be honest, and this was only a couple of years ago, I really didn't care that much about the Bitcoin side of things. All I cared was that my oil production was online. It was slowly, once I had that on my site and started going down the rabbit hole that all of us have obviously fell into at some point in time, that's when I started realizing, like, you know, this is something that could be so much more and obviously can grow with the oil and gas industry, which is my expertise. And so over the last couple of years, just digging into it more and more, trying to go, you know, going down that rabbit hole and seeing what the potentials were. That was when it came to a point where my business partner and I at this oil company, you know, we said, let's try to do this on a full-time basis. We've got some ideas of, you know, things that worked for us, things that didn't work, and how we could change, you know, make our business model to be something that, we can grow and scale to. And, you know, and that's what we've tried to do here in Wyoming. So that was my entrance into it. It was really as a means to keep my oil production online at the start.
Well, Zach, I think I would say like around the Antminer S9 when that came out, that's really when this became industrialized to the point, because the Antminer S9 was where it, I mean, I don't know how many were produced, but we're talking hundreds of thousands of those devices, right? Before that, you know, your Antminer S7 and some other models like reaching, going up to it. But, you know, that was the period of like hyper depreciation of the ASIC, and there was new ASICs coming out every few months. So once I sort of like look at that era, like the S9 sort of marked the start in my head of the industrial era of mining. So before that, Bitcoin mining from say 2009 to 2011, you'd have no hope in hell of doing, there'd be no point doing this on an oil field because nobody had rigs that were drawing lots of power. The point of mining on oil field isn't to mine Bitcoin. I wouldn't say the whole point, but in all the emissions reduction scenarios like flare and vent, the point is to reduce the flare event. So you need a lot of power. So before the S9, that would have been a lot harder to do. It was really the industrialization of these computers and the rapid expansion of mining and the power level that allowed it to become industrial in my head. So I would say around that 2016, maybe 2015 timeframe is when it really started to become viable to do it in oil field. So I'm not surprised. Like I haven't heard of much happening before that time frame in oil field, simply because like even if it's a small vent gas project, like some of the small ones we do, which is like say 50 kilowatt, you know, you do that in 2012, like what are you going to run? Like FPGAs, like to 50 kilowatt, like nobody was doing that. So it just wasn't really viable. And that's why, you know, and we're all on the same page here. I think like, I've always thought when you look at the trend of how mining is industrializing, commoditizing, I see oil and gas getting better and better and better for oil and gas producers over time, because I see the biggest thing holding back oil and gas producers now from just doing this and doing it all themselves is the cost. Like the cost of these computers is ridiculous. When in 10 more years, when these computers are just like sitting on shelves and in storage places all over the planet and they're super cheap, that's when I think you're going to see oil field just like go like really dominate the space, because oil field has the most waste. There's no doubt.
So what you're saying is we need another bear market and have ASIC prices drop, and then we'll get the whole oil and gas industry on board basically.
Well, I think more production, just more time. It's just more time. We could have a perma bull market. It'll get there, because the suppliers they'll be more competitive, right? Hopefully one day there's no more monopoly on semiconductors, and you know, it's being produced in multiple countries.
Sure. Yeah, Marty, same question to you. Like, did you see like a particular catalyst in why like the ESG narrative has become so prominent in Bitcoin mining related conversations recently? Like what was the catalyst or threshold that, you know, triggered that?
About ESG?
Yeah, ESG.
I mean, it is just the historical, like, is Bitcoin answering this, or like the oil and gas thinking of Bitcoin in an ESG perspective?
Yeah, all together, kind of. Yeah.
From my experience, obviously we operate predominantly in North Dakota, and similar to what Ryan described in Wyoming, in North Dakota they flare. I don't know if it's number of days or volume of flare, but if they flare a certain amount, they shut down production and shut down all their oil production. They want to do that. They want to prevent that at all costs. And so us coming in and saying, "Hey, we'll buy that gas. We'll help you mitigate your flare." And actually allow you to turn that gas stream that would otherwise be considered trash gas into a revenue stream. That's the thing. Like what we do upstream on the well pad, it's inarguable. Like we're reducing waste, we're contributing to the Bitcoin network, which is the most transparent and open network available to humanity at the moment, and the governance structure, we're participating in that to a certain extent, being the facilitators of transactions, and it's a very fair process. So objectively speaking, the way ESG is put forward, it is does tick those boxes, and I think if anything, just the no-brainer easiness solution that Bitcoin mining provides, just it makes it easy. So yeah, we're ESG compliant, we're reducing flare with Bitcoin mining. However, I think at least from the conversations I'm having, people are more driven by profits and the ability to eliminate that waste, not only eliminate it but turn it into a significant revenue stream. So I think Bitcoin mining being a variable which affects the opportunity cost at the business decision level is really what's driving a lot of these. Like I can turn this flare from a cost on my balance sheet to a potential multiple on what I'm getting per MCF at market prices. I think that is what is getting a lot of the wildcatters excited, particularly in the Permian. It's interesting how there's different. It reminds me of, so I come from a finance background, the difference between like Chicago finance and New York finance, like the Bakken, the Permian, all these other shales have sort of different approaches to how they attack the market, from my perspective at least, being a newcomer to the oil and gas world.
I want to kind of change the conversation a little bit to my intro question from the top of the show. Just wondering about the reception of this green mining movement within the Bitcoin mining ecosystem itself. So 2 weeks ago or a week ago, there's a Bitmain conference in Miami, and there's a lot of people who got on stage and touted Bitcoin, green Bitcoin mining tech.
Scammers, every one of them.
So how did
straight up
straight Bitcoin up. Maximalism gets a bad rap, but it also has its values within the Bitcoin mining ecosystem itself, which is so relationally driven. How do you deal with these people? Like, is it worth interacting with them, or do you just like not give them business?
Stay in your lane and do your thing unless something starts affecting you to the point where you're getting things forced on you because of posturing by these people towards regulators. I think
the three of us on this channel here, like with what we do, like all of us are mostly going after what is otherwise wasted. We are the greenest Bitcoin miners on the planet. Like there's others like us. There's many others like us. There's a rapidly growing industry of people like us, but it's not people like us pushing the ESG narrative. Even though we're the greenest, we're the cleanest, we're the best. The guys on the grid, the guys on who are apologizing for their coal usage because they're betas, like a Core Scientific who uses tons of coal and are buying credits to offset their coal so they can make press releases saying that they're green. These guys, and on one hand, I don't blame them because they're at the mercy of the ESG, like the United Nations, the United Nazis. They have no choice but to comply with, and we do too. Like every business on the planet, we all have to comply with what's coming down the pipe with carbon. The carbon administration and ESG administration. There's not really, you can't say no because you can't hide. The only people that can say no are the black market people, the people that are doing this illegally, like mining under the radar. They're the only ones that cannot comply with ESG stuff. But I mean, like the problem I have when I see guys like Core and other big name miners, like really big, like the really big miners we all hear about, right? They're building these massive facilities, like the big industrial North American miners. I mean, on one hand, I totally understand why they're doing what they're doing, like why they're buying carbon credits. They're very visible. They're very big. They're more than any of us. They're at the behest of regulatory rules. And they're at more risk to regulatory rules because they're very big and visible and very impactful. But that being said, you can still comply. Okay, you can still buy your carbon credits. You can still do whatever you think you have to do to comply and be able to operate your business as profitably as you can without legitimizing this bullshit. Because most of these guys, they're really just positioning themselves. Especially you see now, like the guys like talking about like, well, green mining pools and clean coins and like, coin, you know, not mining blocks that have dirty coins in them and all this shit. Like they're only doing that to position themselves for the upcoming regulatory attacks. That's what I think they're doing. But with the only problem I have with it, and I like to call them out on it all the time, but is like, you could do what you're doing. You could do all that. It's all fine. You just don't have to legitimize this nonsense, because at the end of the day, you're putting yourself in you're pushing a narrative that is going to end up discriminating against the smaller miners, like let's say boutique shops, like little farms that, you know, might have a megawatt or two here and there. They can't afford hiring staff to brown nose with these regulators and put these ESG programs in place. And that's part of the why I hate this ESG stuff, because it discriminates against smaller companies. Like that's an overhead on top of your company. It's a new overhead. This ESG stuff is a new cost. And small companies can't afford that the same way the big companies can. For the big companies, it's nothing. Like it's like you hire 10 people to full-time make sure your business has this narrative in place, like all your, you know, your ESG reporting and this and that. Small companies can't do that. Like I can't afford to hire people to do that. Like, so luckily I'm not in a position where I'm mining off beautiful coal and I have to like write a report saying why should I be allowed to mine off coal? Luckily, my position right now is we're not a high emissions miner, but there are high emissions miners out there, high emissions like in regards to, okay, you're using mostly coal or a grid based on mostly coal. And unfortunately, when you are out there, you know, putting out press releases that, you know, you're green and you're mining clean blocks and stuff, you end up, it's going to create a more of a discriminatory environment where you're basically just posturing and it's a form of lobbying. You're just trying to get in good favor with the regulators while screwing over everyone else who, cause it's frankly just not a legitimate, it's just the whole thing isn't legitimate. So
sure.
That's the stuff that ticks me off. Cause I do understand why they do it, but well, man, they can go about it a little bit differently.
Well, and I think another thing that's extremely frustrating is because Bitcoin mining, the industry, the natural incentives of the industry just literally naturally push us towards energy efficiency and reducing waste, just because the nature of the business is such that you have to drop your cost down as low as possible. And what provides the lowest cost, that is being what is being wasted or stranded, because nobody else is willing to get it to market. You can bring the market to where it's being wasted, which is the beauty of Bitcoin. Never in human history have we had this mechanism to profitably utilize these wasted and stranded energy sources. And so I feel like the Mugatu meme. I feel like I'm taking crazy pills, because this should be considered one of the greatest boons to conservationism that the world has ever come into contact with. And yet we are constantly attempting to defend ourselves and rationalize, and it does get exhausting. But if you understand what we're doing, again, it's the greatest boon to conservationism that potentially has ever hit humanity in the last 300 years. I don't know why I threw out 300, potentially ever. I don't know.
And
yeah.
beyond just like the energy stuff, you're just saying, like, even Bitcoin itself as a money, like it punishes capital misallocation, right? If you go and spend money on something, there's no bailouts. So it's like, not only is it the energy, the invention of having portable markets, like Marty was saying, that's amazing. Like, it's the most greenest technology in the history of mankind. Yeah. On top of that, you have the soundest money system in the history of mankind that is just multiplying that. So like, it's, yeah, it's crazy pills. Like, that's why I feel like I am going insane, because like all this shit that we're reading all the time is so wrong. It's so wrong. All the media is so wrong. And you know, how do you get that across to people? Well, I don't think we are going to get it across to them. Bitcoin needs to defund them. That's the only possibility in my mind on a path forward.
Yeah. Ryan, did you want to jump in there? Keep in mind too. Yeah. So, you know, Steve brought up, you know, like clean coins. So you can talk about, you know, our miners going to start saying, you know, which some obviously have, that, you know, my coins are cleaner than yours, et cetera. Really, you know, there's a few fundamental parts of Bitcoin that, you know, make it, you know, why it's so great, and fungibility is one of them. And if you've got people that are starting to say, you know, I've got a clean coin and you've got a dirty coin, well, what makes that up, and how do you authenticate that? And so now you have to centralize Bitcoin to some kind of an exchange or a regulatory body that keeps the entire process and transactional history of that Bitcoin in place and has a set, you know, governing system that says this is a clean coin because it meets all of our criteria. Well, if the United States has one form of that and China has one form, and, you know, name every country in the world, they all are going to have different ideas on what constitutes a clean or a dirty coin. And so now you need to, if you want to have the ultimate clean coin, you need to be a part of every regulatory body, and it meets everything. I mean, it's completely goes against the ethos of what Bitcoin is, and decentralization is where the only way to actually have a clean coin is to completely centralize
and censor, you know,
the entire process. Yeah. So,
well, and if you understand the nature of Bitcoin at a technical level, it's literally impossible. These UTXOs come with history. Like, you don't know who was producing the hashes that were provided to the mining pool that allowed them to mine that particular block, with all these transactions that came from previous other blocks. Like, it's literally impossible to ever have a clean coin, just due to the nature of how the push UTXO system of Bitcoin works.
Yeah. And then on top of that, you know, the it was brought up about, you know, the carbon credit system. And, you know, I completely agree that people need to have more of an understanding and education when a company's putting out a press release to say, you know, we're 100% green, clean, or renewable. Well, what does that actually mean? And like, everyone has a different opinion on that as to what is green, and they should have a different opinion on it. And so when a company says, you know, there's a Bitcoin mining company that says we're carbon negative. And it's like, okay, well, what does that even mean? And it's like, they're saying that we're using a 100% clean renewable source. And on top of that, we're also buying carbon credits. And so, you know, we're carbon negative. And so when you start looking at those things, it's like, well, what even is a carbon offset or a carbon credit? And let's dig into that. And how are they even produced? And how are they sold? And how is that tracked? And you start realizing that, you know, the process is in place. It's very hard for somebody who's even in that industry to completely explain it to someone that you go, that doesn't really make sense. And so you've got industries that, because the government or some regulatory body likes that particular form of energy intensity or what they're doing, they now have the ability to sell a product to other people so they can continue down their path, but buy that product, which is nothing. You're buying literally nothing. But now you can say that you reduced your carbon. Well, those processes would have happened regardless.
You're not buying nothing. You're paying the protection. You're paying the mafia.
It's indulgences.
It's the guys that's coming to your store saying, hey, pay us up so I'll protect you. That's what you're doing. Like, that's the carbon mafia is the product you're buying. That's really all.
So I would just really like if, you know, companies could actually come out and say, look, we're 100% carbon neutral, or we're green, clean. And it's like, well, explain that. Like, how does that work? Like, why does you buying carbon offsets make your operation better than someone else's? You know, it's pure hypocrisy. It really is.
I mean, it's a form of something. It's like Steve mentioned, like greasing the mafia or paying indulgences to the Catholic Church. It's exactly the same. It's just bureaucratic BS that is meant to intimidate and
is to keep them from coming down and slamming big carbon taxes on your company. That's all they're doing it for, because they know the guys that are doing that are mostly guys like on coal or something, where they're worried about how they're going to look. And I don't blame them, because unfortunately society's lost its mind thinking coal is bad. But you know, I mean, that's really all it is. It's like, oh, we're mining on coal. Okay, we're in a shaky spot. Let's de-risk this by paying them, bribing them with our anti-coal money. And that's really all that is about. Because there's no product. There's no product. You're just giving it to them. It's administered by the United Nations. And I mean,
I guess, yeah, you get to check the box though and write a press release about it. Well, there's a miner I won't name, but he says the mining press release heroes are his least favorite people in the industry. They live or die by those press releases.
I know we're laughing here, and we're talking specifically about Bitcoin mining and the industry, but I think it is imperative to really highlight that this goes beyond Bitcoin mining, this whole ESG movement. And it is in a way. Like, there was a great clip going around of Dave Smith explaining how Mussolini defined fascism himself. And it was the sort of melding of the corporations and the government. And that seems to be a step, ESG, in that direction. The UN's coordinated government action to define 2030 goals that then get implemented by these corporations. Like, that is how Mussolini defined fascism. That's what worries me the most. Again, what we're doing naturally here in the Bitcoin mining industry, specifically what Jay Upstream and Great American Mining are doing, is considered ESG. But I don't like that. I just like that we're looking to be profitable, and it's just a byproduct of what we do. When you try to force the state and corporations melding together to force it upon economic actors, that's when things get weird. It's the takeover of the means of production, not physically and so overtly. It's just done in a more subversive way, I would imagine.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. It definitely goes beyond Bitcoin mining. Obviously, you know, Bitcoin mining is industry we most care about immediately, but it's definitely not isolated to that industry. And like, in many senses, Bitcoin mining is sort of the newcomer to this whole conversation. People have been straddled with this burden of ESG hypocrisy and ambiguity for decades. And I guess, like, we're sort of at time here, but it's important to understand, you know, the narrative that's being foisted upon us, ways that we can combat it. And also, like, sort of we hinted at earlier in this conversation, like, things and people and companies that are probably better let off just ignored. Let them do their thing. Let them play their games. And we know our goal and our mission, what we're trying to build, and then leave it at that. we could probably talk for, you know, 10 more hours about this, but we are at time. Ryan, Steve, Marty, this has been super fun for me and educational, hearing more of your thoughts and opinions, perspectives on this. Really appreciate your time. For everyone watching, all three of them are on Twitter. All three of them are super informative and also prolific shit posters. Ryan, maybe not so much, but we'll get him there eventually. Definitely throw them a follow. And Will and I are also there. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're watching this. Shows every week, Wednesday and Fridays. But pertinent to this conversation, to all three of you, thank you again so much. This has been a ton of fun. I've enjoyed it a lot.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for having me.
Good catching up with all you guys again.
It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, always a good time. I think that's a wrap.